Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Steve Flink, Hall of Famer Steve Flink, who is just a veteran tennis journalist, formerly of World Tennis, author of several books, and also writes, contributes to the U.S. Open Daily. And boy, Steve Flink, you've been around for a long time.
Some people are delighted about that. Maybe others aren't. No, I've been very fortunate, you know, to have been writing about tennis for more than 50 years and have been around it so long. And, of course, through much of that period, you've been there with me.
That's right. Gosh, 43 for me, Steve Flink. And we're sitting in the broadcast booth here overlooking the Arthur Ashe Stadium court at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. And I can remember when, you know, this was just the National Tennis Center before Billie Jean King even got the recognition she deserved.
Well, they moved over here, and as I know you remember, in 1978, they've been at Forest Hills through 77. Big switch because Forest Hills had switched from grass to clay. Then they came here to the hard courts where they've been ever since. And you're right. It was just Louis Armstrong Stadium was the main stadium. There was no such thing as Arthur Ashe Stadium. That didn't come until 97. Nearly 20 years. So the evolution of this place is pretty remarkable.
I remember the Louis Armstrong press box. That place was an adventure in itself, just getting up there if the elevators worked. And it was so small, and everybody was crammed in there, and the journalists, a lot of journalists were smoking, and you know, I was handwriting my radio scripts for WFAN back then.
And you also probably remember, too, I mean, that was largely the result, in my understanding, the PR guy at the time had worked at Penn Football, Ed Fabricius, who was a great guy. And Ed, I think, honestly thought because the football, in college football, that's where you'd locate the press room, and they do their writing up there. But he didn't realize that for tennis, that was not ideal. That was not the ideal spot. And so the press, a lot of times they're up there working. There was a press section down below, but that was quite a hike to get to the top of it. Either you hiked it on foot or you went in the elevator, which was rather shaky.
And I understand they're going to be doing some improvements here in the Ash Stadium court in the fall, putting a lot of money into it, restoring some of or renovating some of the VIP suites, and they're going to put a couple more elevators to get up here to the broadcast booths up here overlooking the Ash court. So they're always thinking of things, Steve, and expanding the schedule, the mixed doubles, the first, you know, during qualifier week, and just so many innovations to you, and you've been here for so many years. What has been the most meaningful innovation, in your opinion, here at this National Tennis Center?
Well, I think we alluded to it. I mean, I think this move, building the big Arthur Ashe Stadium, which was a step up. There was nothing wrong with Armstrong. Armstrong had its own electric atmosphere, but it didn't match what was produced here in Ashe Stadium. And then the next thing was when finally they put up the roof, and then they later put up a roof over Armstrong as well. But I remember Federer and Djokovic had played a final in 2015, delayed by 3 hours because it started to rain about 10 minutes before the match. Beautiful day up until then. 3-hour delay. Luckily, by the next year, we had the roof and no longer had to experience anything like that. So I'd say, number one, just the emergence, the building of Ashe Stadium. Secondly, the roof, which they really needed very badly.
You know, it's interesting you said that because the guys who operate the roof and, you know, all the engineers are in the booth next to this booth here, and they have the roof up now, but it looks beautiful outside. So I'm wondering what the deal is if they're predicting rain for tonight.
You would think so. I can't think of any other reason why. You're right. We can see the skyline. There's some clouds, but there's a lot of blue sky out there as well. So no telling what the reasoning is.
But you're absolutely right. What an innovation, and it's really kept things much more on schedule when they're able to put this roof up. Let's talk, though, about one of my favorite subjects in tennis, and that is rivalries. That is, you know, the big three for so many years that, you know, that we were covering this sport, Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, and how wonderful it is that Novak Djokovic, at the age of 38, is still playing and still going strong.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable that people talk about his so-called decline. He's been in three straight Grand Slam semifinals this year, and he's back in the quarters playing Taylor Fritz tonight, try to get to a fourth in a row at 38. But you're right, to get to the rivalries, they're the lifeblood of the sport. That's what the fans want. You think of some of the great rivalries in the past, Sampras and Agassi, Everton, Navratilova, Graf and Selis. This is what really the spectators find most compelling. And that trio that you started off with there, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, there's been nothing like that to have the cross rivalries. You know, it started, of course, with Roger and Rafa was the first big rivalry among that trio. And they started at one stage, and they played three straight French Open finals, and the same years played in the Wimbledon finals. 2006 to 2008, we're talking about. 3 years in a row, they're playing the French and Wimbledon finals against each other. And then, of course, Djokovic was a little behind them, and he trailed both of them significantly in their personal rivalries. But then he came to the forefront, particularly starting in 2011. And so he built quite a rivalry with both Roger and Rafa himself. So we were spoiled. We have been spoiled because Novak is the only member of the iconic trio who remains. Fans appreciate him more than ever now, but he was what he did in those, and he came out on top, by the way, head to head against both Rafa and Roger. He was 27-23 against Roger and 31 wins, 29 losses against Rafa, coming from far back in each of those series. So it's just a spectacular era.
It really was. How fortunate we are, as you mentioned, to have experienced that, to see those rivalries. Roger Federer versus Rafael Nadal, when I looked at that head-to-head, Steve Flink, Federer had 16 wins to Nadal's 24 wins, which, you know, yeah, Nadal won the more of those matches. But I also see that Nadal won five major titles against Federer. So part of...
It was actually six. Yeah, but the thing is, Ann, what's interesting, you mentioned 24-16, is that Roger surprisingly won six of the last seven against Rafa. Mm-hmm. It was much more one-sided. It looked better in the end for Roger because he made some inroads toward the end, including a big semifinal win over Rafa in the semifinals of Wimbledon in 2019 before he lost an epic to Novak where he had two match points before going down in a fifth set tiebreak. So, yeah, the Federer-Nadal rivalry was enhanced in a way by that resurgence from Federer at the end, which included a big win over Rafa at the 2017 Australian Open in the final where he came from 3-1 down in the fifth. Just so many. We could sit here, Ann, for 2.5 hours and we would just be scratching the surface.
Right, absolutely, because it started in 2004, their rivalry,
yes.
And culminated in 2019. Right. That is an incredible amount of time.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, Rafa had that win over Roger in 2004, and then their first major meeting was 2005 at the French. So those went on. I mean, they were meeting at the majors from 2005 all the way up to 2019. And not much different when you look at the Rafa-Novak rivalry or the Novak-Roger rivalry. I will say this, Ann, my personal taste was different from most. Most people would say Nadal-Federer was the most intriguing. There was more contrast. This left-handed Spaniard who hitting those punishing ground strokes with his heavy topspin against Roger, who was such a classic attacking player and the most elegant player of the trio. And so you had a nice contrast in their methodology, not so much when you had Djokovic playing Nadal. But to me, the most fun for some reason, for many reasons, was Djokovic playing Federer. I just really enjoyed it. They played so many big matches in the latter stages of Roger's career and when Novak was peaking. They played the finals of Wimbledon in 2014, 2015, again in 2019. They played here in 2015. And there was something about undercurrent of those matches. They weren't necessarily that fond of each other, but they were very respectful. But they just would go all out in these fierce, big hitting exchanges from the baseline. I enjoyed those matches every bit as much, if not more, than Nadal versus Federer.
Yeah, just one quick thing before we move on to Djokovic and Federer. Federer versus Nadal, is it true they never met at the U.S. Open?
Absolutely true. Yeah, that was the one disappointment, and they came so close. So close in 2008. I could give you countless examples, but 2008, Rafa surprisingly lost to Murray in the semis, who then lost to Federer. And then the closest they came was both 2010 and 2011, when each of those years, Novak recovered from double match point down to beat Federer. So Federer was, you know, That's how close they were to meeting, because Nadal was in the finals of both of those events. So they would have played those years. And even 2013, when Roger suffered a shocking loss in one of his worst years to Tommy Robredo of Spain, they would have actually met that year in the quarters. So they were, and they both were in the fourth round. So many close calls. And what a shame they couldn't have rounded it out by playing, because, you know, by playing here, because Novak and Roger, they met in all four majors, you know, and so did Novak and Rafa. But strangely, Federer and Nadal, it just didn't happen here. And what a shame for the fans that they didn't get to see it in New York.
Right. It's just amazing to me, all those years that they played and they never met at a U.S. Open, and they were one match away from meeting, what, six different times? Just extraordinary. So you think the most compelling matchup in those rivalries was Djokovic against Federer?
You know, that's my personal preference, because I just remember those matches. That Wimbledon final to me was one of my favorite matches ever, because Federer served for the match at 8-7 in the fifth, double match point on his serve. Djokovic recovered. They went to 12-all. They were playing the tiebreak at 12-all that year, and Djokovic wins in a tiebreak. But listen, I still say the best match I ever saw, I haven't changed my mind on that, was Nadal beating Federer in the 2008 Wimbledon final, which he won 9-7 in the fifth on the edge of darkness. They didn't have five more minutes left to play. It was about 9:16 in the evening when it ended. So we're talking about narrow margins here, because all three rivalries had so much to offer.
You know, maybe that is one reason, you know, Federer versus Djokovic. Federer was so likable, and particularly here at the U.S. Open. People loved him here in New York.
No, wait, Ann, I'm going to stop you there. They loved him everywhere he went, and at every stage of his career, wherever he went. I have to say, you're right, he was beloved here. Don't get me wrong. It's just I couldn't get over how whatever stadium I walked into in the world, and what it didn't matter whether it was the young Roger, the dominant Roger, or the Roger in the autumn of his career, it didn't make any difference. They absolutely supported him. I think a lot of it had to do with how he played. He comported himself very well, too. We know that. He was a sportsman, but not that the other two weren't. But I think it was more than anything the elegance of his game, the beauty of his game, that's what made the spectators flock to him and always want to cheer for him.
Sure. Just effortless, just, you know, a ballet style, beautiful, you know, just movement. His movement was so graceful and beautiful. But I do believe because of his popularity, it almost became a nemesis for Novak Djokovic, because it took a long time for people to appreciate Novak Djokovic's greatness, even when he was winning and beating these top players.
No doubt about it. But it wasn't just about Roger. It was about Rafa, too, because the Roger fans were kind of okay. If he was going to lose to anybody, they'd pick Rafa. They'd say, okay, I can accept that. And vice versa, same deal. But for some reason, that generosity of spirit was not extended to Djokovic. Maybe because he was just more out front and outspoken and clear about his goals, and he wasn't disrespectful toward them, but he made it clear that his goal was to achieve more than anybody, and he didn't want anybody getting in his way. There was a directness about him and how he conducted himself. Plus, he was more human. You know, there's sometimes when he'd smash rackets, things would happen to him. While Roger and Rafa were almost always impeccably behaved, Novak was more human, but he also brought so many great qualities to the arena. But people, they were slow to accept him. You and I were talking about this earlier down below, Ann, watching one of the matches, and I do believe that right now, because he's the last member of the trio left, that there is an appreciation of him that was never there before, because they understand, first of all, he's not competing against their heroes anymore, and secondly, they realize what it took for him to surpass both of those guys numerically, and he did.
Oh, absolutely. With, 24 major singles titles to Rafael Nadal, who finished with 22, Roger Federer with 20. I always thought it would be Roger, five-time U.S. Open champion, who would have more singles titles than any other player, but it came out to be Novak Djokovic.
Exactly. Keep in mind, and you were at one stage, you were right. He's the man who at 2009 Wimbledon, when he beat Andy Roddick in the final, moved ahead of Pete Sampras, and that had seemed at one time inconceivable, Pete's 14. Roger got to 15 then. And then he kept his lead for quite a few years after that. And it didn't seem like, for a long time, it didn't seem like either Rafa or Novak could catch him. But they both surpassed him. That's the remarkable thing. Not just Novak, but the fact that Rafa also surpassed him. So, I mean, it was just an exhilarating era in that sense. And they drove each other on. Let's face it. They all inspired each other. And there was a battle to improve. They wanted to improve their games. They wanted to improve their numbers. And so what that took constantly going through each other was remarkable.
And surprising that Roger retired before Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, it's true. But, of course, 5-6 years older, I mean, and his knees were giving out on him by then. So in some ways he didn't have a choice, which was too bad. Well, Rafa and Novak are only about a year apart in age. And actually, the most surprising thing to me was that Rafa managed to somehow keep playing through last year because he had the biggest multitude of injuries of all three of those guys, and somehow he kept coming back from countless different injuries. Originally it was the knees, and he had a serious issue with his foot, and then it was everything under the sun, but somehow he had the resilience to keep returning to the arena. And he had the most injuries. Roger had what ended up being chronic knee troubles, and right. Novak of the three has probably been the most fortunate, but he's also put in incredibly hard work to stay as healthy and to stay away from too many serious injuries, you know, and he's done well with that.
And Novak Djokovic, give him credit. You said, you know, he's always been very opinionated, very direct. He did not want to get vaccinated. He didn't believe in it. He stuck to his guns to the detriment of perhaps winning a couple more major titles.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, Anne. It's true that when this was all coming out, when it was getting to the point where all the players on the tour, depending on what country they were going to, during COVID, they had to have that vaccine. Novak understood that up front and realized he might pay a price for his stand. So the biggest case was the 2022 Australian Open when he actually flew over there, and then it just turned into a mess because the government told him, you know, he couldn't play. There was an appeal, and originally it was going his way. Then it was rescinded and eventually had to go home. And then he missed a U.S. Open here, too. You know, would he won two or three more? We'll never know, because I also think, would he have necessarily won three majors in 2023 had he already won a couple more before that? If he'd been in a better shape with his numbers, maybe the incentive, the motivation wouldn't have been quite as great. So I think the 2023 season was really commendable on his part, what he did after all that stuff with COVID and missing majors and not being able to play here, not being able to play Australia 1 year, to win three of the four that year. And winning here at the U.S. Open, oldest champion ever at 36, 2 years ago. That I think that will go down maybe as perhaps his most satisfying year.
Sure. And he has a chance to do it again. He's 38. It would be wonderful for him to get to 25 all-time Grand Slam singles titles. Is that significant in your opinion?
Yes and no. It's a nice round number. It would separate him from all tennis players, men and women. But to me, the big battle, again, is it's men versus men, women versus women. Margaret has the record for women, all credit to her, although she got what I think were some cheap Australian Opens when the fields were not very strong there in the 60s. But nonetheless, still great achievement. But Novak worked so hard to move past both Rafa and Roger, first Roger, then Rafa, getting past them both, getting to his 24, that to me is much more meaningful. And it would be like icing on the cake. It would be very gratifying to win a major at 38, and you're so right. But does he need it? No, I think he really did need that 23rd and 24th. That was what mattered to him more than anything, was to surpass his greatest rivals and surpass all of the men in the history of the game.
Absolutely. What an achievement. So looking back at those three, would you say, based on Djokovic's numbers, he would be the all-time great of all those three, based on his career wins and major titles?
Yes. I mean, I think that's the prevailing view. That's certainly my view, because you start with the slams. So he beat them in the slams. Then you look at their head-to-heads. He's winning record against both. Then you look at the Masters 1000s, which are the next most important. He's got 40 of those, more than Roger or Rafa. Then you look at weeks at number one, far more than either one, 428, and he also finished 8 years at number one. They had five each. Mm-hmm. So I look at all that. I see so many crucial statistical errors. Now, some people would want to argue, and some Federer fans would argue that his best tennis was better than either of those guys. I think that's open to question. You could make the case that Roger, primetime Roger of 2004 to 2007, was better than Novak at any stage or better than Rafa, but neither one of them Rafa was already starting to peak on clay, but only on clay in that period, and Novak had not peaked anywhere yet. So I don't think so. I think you have to really look at it more statistically, and they all had great technical qualities, but that statistically he clearly surpassed them. And I don't think either Roger or Rafa would argue with that.
Right, and he's still going strong. Novak Djokovic at 38. Now let's look at him versus Jannik Sinner. He's only 24. Jannik beating Djokovic, the last four times they play, I believe. And Sinner has that head-to-head, is winning that head-to-head at this point.
Yeah, he's giving away too many years to Sinner and Alcaraz. He's actually up 5-3 against Carlos, which is remarkable. Carlos is 16 years younger. Jannik is 14 years younger. And people used to make a very big deal out of Roger being 5 years older than Rafa. Or, 5-6 year age gap with Rafa and Novak, and they thought that was sort of unfair. It was a real disadvantage for him, and this is three times as long a span. So Sinner has obviously started to peak in these last few years, and also he plays more like Novak than Carlos does. Mm-hmm. Carlos is more adventuresome, so. Those have been trickier matches for Novak. He was able to beat Jannik most of the time through the end of 2023. Since then, he has not. But it's understandable given the age disparity and given the playing style that Sinner is in some ways not quite a mirror image, but close enough with the way he plays the game. So he's giving nothing away, and maybe he's a little bit faster at this stage. And so it makes sense. Well, Carlos, more audacious, more of a risk taker. So Novak on certain days has out-dueled him, including for the Olympic gold medal that was his most impressive win over Carlos. Two tiebreakers last summer at Roland Garros in the final. So, and again, that's the last piece we didn't even talk about is, yes, Rafa won the Olympic singles. Roger never did, but Novak was able to add that. So he had everything else, including all those year-end championships. But he also beat Carlos remarkably in the quarters of the Australian this year. So he's continued to do better against Carlos in the last year and a half than he has against Jannik. But who knows? Maybe he's got one more big win left in him against Jannik. I don't put it past him on a given day to beat Sinner. He's just not going to beat him the majority of the time anymore.
All right. So I know it's a bit of an intangible because the other guys, but at their prime, putting Sinner in the mix, putting Alcaraz in the mix, Roger, Rafael, Djokovic, who would you say is the best player in their prime?
Well, yeah, that's what I was sort of getting at there, that some would argue that was Roger. I wouldn't. I think there's no clear choice there. That's why I say you have to look at the numbers. And we're never going to be able to properly compare Novak or the other two, obviously, to Sinner and Alcaraz. There's a little crossover era going on right now. The fans are being treated to these what are going to be briefer rivalries between Djokovic and Alcaraz, Djokovic and Sinner. But the long-term rivalry would be Alcaraz and Sinner. So I don't know. I would just say this. Alcaraz resembles Federer more in the sense of this sort of natural flowing talent, all-around ability, that on given days he's just unstoppable and is an immovable force. He's just got too many shots, and if they're all clicking and he's on, you could argue that nobody could beat him. But I think we have to judge these guys, on the entirety of their work. And the other guy that I would throw into this, by the way, that I do believe that on courts like these and at Wimbledon would challenge any of these people and hold his own is Pete Sampras, because he had the greatest serve we've ever seen, and he had one of the great match-playing temperaments as well. Very unshakable on the court. So I would put him very much in that conversation.
And of all those guys you mentioned, all the greats, who was the most mentally tough, would you say?
I'd say Djokovic. Sampras close, but I think that's what's actually separated Novak from, and Rafa is close behind too. And I would put both of them over Roger, which is no knock on Roger because he's been very remarkably mentally tough in his own way too. But Djokovic has recorded more clutch wins, and including the two here that I mentioned in the semis against Roger, both from double match point down in 2010, 2011, the Wimbledon final saving two match points in 2019. And then a couple of clutch wins over Rafa at the 2012 Australian final, which 5 hours and 53-minute match, and he came from a breakdown in the fifth, and a Wimbledon 10-8 in the fifth semi. Just so many of those matches that were hanging in the balance, he somehow found a way to win. So that's why I'd have to put him down as the greatest competitor.
Switching over to the women. And it was great to see the homage, the tribute they paid to Chrissy Everett in her 50th anniversary since winning, right, the U.S. What was it back then, the U.S. Open, or was it the U.S.? It was U.S. Right. Open back then. Jeez, I can't believe it was 50. It's been 50 years.
Yeah.
But what are your thoughts about rivalries in the women's game?
Her rivalry with Martina stretched from 73 to 88, 80 matches, 43 for Martina wins and 37 for Chrissy. Chrissy early on dominating Martina, 20-4, big lead. Martina comes roaring back and starts dominating. One stage won 13 in a row, but then Chrissy at the end started holding her own again. Fantastic rivalry. What made that one so special was the complete contrast in styles. Although Chrissy did improve her net game a lot and started to come in more in the latter stages of her career, primarily known for counterattacking, her great two-handed backhand, the passing shots, Martina serving and volleying all the time. Left-hander versus right-hander, it had it all. And so I think that was the premier, frankly, that was the premier rivalry I think I've ever seen in tennis, period, even more so than the great ones we're just discussing. I wouldn't put it by a wide margin, but I would rate it over those for a variety of reasons. Another one would be Graf and Selis, too short, but the matches that they played in this period before both before and after Monica was stabbed in the back in Germany in the 90s were fantastic. They had an epic French Open final in 92, 10-8 in the third to Monica, and a great one here in 95 after Monica came back. The problem with that one is it didn't last long enough because Monica didn't stay quite at that level after her return. And the Williams sisters, you'd put it up there. The problem with that one is I think people – they appreciated the incredible athleticism, the speed, and the power of both players, but there was a sameness to it. They weren't identical, but they were so close that the tennis itself was not necessarily as enjoyable as it's been in some of these other rivalries. I mean, you got to salute them because at one stage they played in 5 out of 6 major finals, a couple in a row. I mean, every major, they're meeting the finals of every major too. But were the contests as enjoyable as some of the others? I don't think so. It takes nothing away from them and their gifts and their talent. But from a spectator standpoint, they weren't quite as much fun.
Right. But watching Martina Navratilova all those years and Chrissy Everett, they both brought such a different game to the court. And to see them all these years later, you know, they both overcame health issues, you know, very severe health issues.
Yeah.
They're both broadcasting here at the Open and around at all the other major championships. It's a joy. It's been a joy to really follow their careers, I'm sure, for you as well, Steve.
Oh, it absolutely has. And they have represented the game so impeccably, both of them, and the respect they have for each other. There was some strain for a while when Nancy Lieberman was coaching Martina, because she, at that stage in the early 80s, she felt that Martina had to dislike all her opponents, including Chrissy, that was the only way she would get the best out of herself competitively. But that was short-lived, and they moved past that without any doubts, and they remain good friends to this day. And yes, they have. It's true about the health issues, and they both have battled cancer, and they're healthy now, and they're here now, and it's great to see it. You're right.
Hall of Fame, Steve Flink. That must have been a super memory for you, just getting inducted into the Hall of Fame yourself up in Newport.
It was, and it was hard for me to believe. It was actually 8 years ago, 2017. But also, I was speaking of Chrissy. I was lucky enough that she agreed to be my presenter because I'd been sort of known as her Boswell, the person that sort of knew the most about her career. And I chronicled it so closely, and then we also became friends over time. So she came and spoke for me, which was really very gratifying. I'll always remember that year.
Unbelievable. Well, you are certainly a treasure, and I say that in just the most positive, you know, of ways. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Interview, and continued success, and keep it going, Steve Flink. It's always great to see you.
Great to see you, Ann, and you're very good at what you do. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much.